Welcome to Reflections on Life. I'm Liz Bobo, and I'm happy to be doing this segment of my monthly program on Dragon Radio. I start off each month with reflections on six categories of my life. I held public office for over 25 years, and when I left, I didn't take any official positions, and I wanted my life to be that way, and I still do, but I found that I was sort of drifting without any structure at all. So when I approach my life through these six topics, it gives me a certain kind of structure. They are reflections on home in Columbia, reflections on Zach, my grandson, reflections on Baltimore, my hometown, reflections on public policy, reflections on our planet beyond the United States, and reflections on the universe. So with that simple task, spring is here in Columbia, as it is in Howard County and all over most parts of the United States. And we are so much enjoying the blooms, the cherry blossoms, and the blooms in our yard. In addition to that, we're visited with our annual visit from the community of geese. And as in the past 5 years, we have a female goose who is nesting and on the rim of the pond beyond our house. And the father of these geese to come is guarding the waters around her, guarding back and forth and back and forth to protect her. So we look forward to the birth of the goslings. Reflections on Zach, my grandson, who died at the age of 20 after struggling with brain cancer for 5 years. And my husband and I just got back from a vacation in Morocco. And when we were walking through the souk one day, that's what they call their big outdoor market, and it's very, very crowded, and just enough room for people to go to the forward and another line going the opposite direction. And when we were walking through, someone yelled out, a young man yelled out to my husband, "Oh, I went to Maryland and I knew him." And we wondered, what is he talking about? Well, my husband was wearing a baseball cap that had my grandson's logo, Zacking Against Cancer and University of Maryland. So it was just thrilling to be at the souk in Morocco and have some kid recognize our grandson. Reflections on Baltimore, my hometown. Baltimore is having a very difficult time right now for any of you who follow the news at all, and I'm not going to get into that. I know it's serious stuff going on, but I want to focus on something positive, and that is that there has been a significant amount of money set aside in the state budget for restoration of the Lexington market, which was one of the best city markets in the United States for years. I used to go there with my mom. We would take the streetcar from Edmondson Village into downtown Baltimore. And I am so pleased to see that there's a priority to preserve this market, not just for posterity to see how we used to shop for our groceries, but because they have darn good fresh fruits and vegetables and poultry and seafood. And I'm very happy about that decision in the state budget. Reflection on public policy. I'm going to continue on a very similar note to what I said about Baltimore. There was a significant amount of money put aside to support the Baltimore Symphony, which is a world-renowned symphony beyond our renown for any other thing in the city right now. And we have a woman as the director, and so the state government is going to give as much support as they can to keep this excellent artistic symphony, not only alive, but thriving and doing well. Reflections on our planet beyond the United States. I already mentioned that my husband and I just got back from a visit to Morocco, where we participated in a National Geographic tour, and we were so moved, not surprised, but moved by the incredibly warm reception we got from all of the Moroccans and from the kids on the street who would see us looking somewhat different than they do. And it was just the atmosphere as well as the history and the unbelievable artistic depth of Morocco was a really beautiful experience for us. And finally, Reflections on the Universe. It was reported while we were away in the Washington Post that the first image of the black hole has been determined, achieved by some scientist, and that now the scientific community is getting a look at, to the extent there is anything to look at, what the black hole really is, and that we will probably see ourselves learning a lot more about it in the not too distant future. So having said that, I want to welcome back Bessie Bourdonnave, who we interviewed, it's been over a month now, hasn't it, Bessie? In February, about her work, particularly on the Harriet Tubman School here in Columbia in Howard County, and bigger than that, on the entire issue of the African-American community in Columbia and Howard County and the impact it has had on all of the rest of us. Today, we are also joined by her cousin, Melvin Kelly. And in a little conversation before we started recording, I learned that Melvin has some connections in Baltimore and through the law school, was that correct, in Baltimore or the University of Maryland?
Not there. At one time, I was the chairman of Baltimore Washington Medical Center in Glen Burnie, and I served on the University of Maryland Medical System Board.
I apologize for that mistake, and thank you. Yeah. I knew the University of Maryland was in there, but I didn't get the medical school. So welcome. I'm very glad you're here joining us today. One of the things that I want us to include that we did not talk about the last time you were here with me, Bessie, is what we're learning about a possible connection with the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad here in Howard County. And there's been more than a little bit of talk and writing about the spot under the Cedar Lane Bridge, where if you take a pathway down from where your museum, your Harriet Tubman School, is located, you can find an area where some people are suggesting that possibly it was part of the Underground Railroad. So do either of you have any thoughts on that? Is that just a whim on some people's part? Or do you think there is a real possible connection here with that?
I think it may be a real possible connection. The information came out several years ago in a book published by the African American Culture Museum here in Howard County. The name of the book is called Seeking Freedom. And in that book, it talks about an Indian cave in Simpsonville, Maryland. And they go on to say, at the bottom of the hill on the north bank of Route 32 in Cedar Lane is an old free town, sits a cave cavity in a large boulder known as Indian Cave. This cave is located in a very secluded area just across the street from the Middle Patuxent Creek. Legend has it that before Civil War, a story circulated about 9 runaway slaves who hid themselves in the cave near Route 32 in Cedar Lane. Either intentionally or inadvertently, they avoided destroying a spider web at the mouth of the cave. When the bounty hunters rode by, they shouted that the runaways couldn't be in the cave because the spider web wasn't disturbed. So for me, this has been a story that has been circulating, and I have not heard anything to contrary, so I do believe that this may be a truth.
I kind of think it might be. I know the cave as a boy. My brothers, two brothers and the two older brothers and I, cousins and some
this
friends.
This very same cave?
Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
In the same neighborhood where we used to play. I mean, it was the right across the road from where our swimming hole was on the Middle Branch Patuxent. And whenever it was summer, of course, we worked, too, on the farms and whatever we had to do to make money to get school clothes. But in the summer, whenever we had the opportunity, we were at the swimming hole. and therefore we were also at the cave from time to time. And for us, it was just as young boys do, they get into what my mother and grandparents used to call get into devilment. And so we would hide in the cave. Several of us would hide in the cave, and then one or two of us would be in the woods on either side of the cave, waiting for traffic to come either down 32 down the hill or start up the hill. And then some of us would jump out of the cave and make noise and act crazy and kind of scare the people. And at the time, some of them were still, people still used horses and wagons. And the horse would get frightened too, and sometimes he would take off. And then, of course, we would scamper back through the woods, because if we got caught naturally and got turned into our parents, or that our parents told about us, we could look for a good whooping, as they used to call it. Yeah.
And in our conversation before we went on the air, you told me that you had a sibling or two.
I do have a sibling or two. Uh-huh. I'm the third oldest of 11 children. Both of my older brothers have passed. I had one sister who passed in 1965 of congenital kidney issue. She had been gotten married and had a child, and that issue flared up. And, of course, at that time, dialysis wasn't what it is now. So she wound up at, I think, Georgetown or George Washington University Hospital and didn't make it. And then, of course, I had a younger brother who died in the late 90s.
And did your siblings play in the swimming hole with you?
The girls didn't.
The girls didn't. Interesting.
The girls back then, the girls, there were only a few girls, and they were really our age, but there were older women who would show up from time to time at the swimming hole. But none of our sisters or none of the younger girls ever did that. There was just kind of this unwritten rule that boys did boys things and girls did girls things, did and girl never things. The twain should meet.
I hadn't planned on going down this road in the interview, but I can't help but look over at you, Bessie. Somehow, I don't know if I can picture you ascribing to boys do boy things and girls do girl things. Were you ever in the swimming hole, or is that an unfair question to ask?
No, I wasn't in the swimming hole, but we were a little distance from where Melvin lived. We lived in the Guilford area,
where he lived in the Simpson area. Better.
Yes.
Yeah.
But my dad had a farm, and so I was always on the farm trying to milk his cow. So, you know, when the flies got around a cow and he swapped his tail, I mean, I'd get a good hitting in the face with that cow tail. Yeah. But that's about what I was involved with in terms of childhood.
I was mixing up where you grew up with all the work you did on the Harriet Tubman School, which is in proximity. But, well, all very, very interesting stories. You know, just last night, and I'm not digressing, this really fits with what we're talking about, there was a first showing of a film here at the community college about Jim Rouse's Columbia. And someone in the college or learned of some young people who I happen to know. They're now the age of my kids, in their 50s or 40s. But they did a lot of footage of Jim Rouse in the very early days of Columbia. And now they've put it together working. I don't know if the college actually played an official role with it or if they just lent the theater. And just having gotten back in town, I'm not up on that. But it's quite a good 10 minutes in the film, if not more, is of Jim Rouse talking about the importance and the absolute necessity of integration among all different races and all different classes in his new town of Columbia. And he really has stood out in the history of residential development in this country of having insisted on that. And it's a lot more difficult now. Not only has Jim Rouse died, but it's more difficult with the very funding programs that are and are not available for housing purchase here in the country now. And we have a lot more work to do, I think, on all kinds of relationships among various segments of the population, and none more important than the racial one between African Americans and others. So we heard the story about the Tubman School and how you've been able to get it preserve Bessie, you and others, as an historic landmark. You couldn't get them to put Harriet Tubman High School on there, though, could you?
Nope, we couldn't.
You couldn't do it. You're still trying for that instead of just Harriet Tubman?
I think it's just going to be Harriet Tubman on the building itself, mm-hmm. because it's going to be a museum as well as a culture and educational center. So I think it's just going to be that on the building.
Well, that's a huge accomplishment. Absolutely. There's no way to, that not having school on there can detract from that. But it is an interesting thing to remember that we had this all-black school here right in Howard County. And when did education stop taking place in that school?
1965.
Just about the same time Jim Rouse was getting started on what he was doing here. So I bring that up to simply say that I know that racial integration is still very important here.
If I could say a little bit about the school.
You certainly can. Mm-hmm.
I was in the class of 1953, which was, I think, the third graduating class from Harriet Tubman. Mm-hmm. My grandparents and then the parents and others in this area fought a long time to get that school. And I can remember, and it's really, of course, I don't live in the county anymore. I haven't lived in the county since 1955, 1956. I left to go in the Air Force. But for the it's nice for a person like me, and I'm sure for others who are serving on the Harriet Tubman Foundation here, that the school is going to be turned into a museum and a cultural center. Because I can vividly remember, I can almost, because I've got a graduation picture here, but I can almost vividly remember my graduation day. Because the gentleman who was the superintendent of the school at that time, he would attend our graduations, but he would refuse to hand a diploma to a black child. And that sticks in me today. I vividly remember that. His name was John Yingling. I'll never forget that name.
Yes, me neither. I knew that name myself.
Yeah, and another person I'm sure you know very well, his name is Charlie Miller.
Yes.
Miller was the local Chevrolet dealer, and he was the person who would always hand the black children their diplomas.
Yes, and he liked that.
He relished the idea of doing that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did not shrink from it. At that time, he held no public office. He later served on the county council or as a county commissioner, I guess, at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't shrink from that. He enjoyed doing it.
Well, you've told me a story I didn't know about him. Yeah, I knew him as well. Yeah. And I'm so glad to hear that, you know, really positive information about him. And I guess the fact that I mentioned Jim Rouse having an impact on the importance of racial issues here in this community, but the fact that we're so close to the Mason-Dixon line, too. I mean, it's something that this state was racked, I think, in some ways more strongly and painfully than a lot of other states during the Civil War because of the, you know, people mm-hmm. on both sides of the issue. And that's why I think it's so important, the work you're doing, to get as clear a history out there as possible about race relations here in Howard County. And not just race relations, but the way black families lived and the way, you know, black kids grew up, that there's just so much for us to learn and going forward in our community. Where do you see the greatest need now? Is it economics? Is it availability of housing, which is part of economics? Is it education in improving our, I don't want to say the state of life of the African-American community, but of the entire community, including having the African-American community right in there entwined in the fiber?
I think that there is two big areas, and economics, of course, plays a big part, and education does, too. As I said earlier to you, that it's very difficult for young people now to really get housing here in Howard County because it's so expensive. And a lot of them are just coming out of high school. Some of them are trying to go to college. And so, consequently, a lot of the young people now are spending more time staying at home with their parents until they're able to save up some money. And even that still doesn't help them a lot of times to meet some of the needs that they are experiencing. With the education, there seems to still be a gap in the achievement with the African-American community as well as other groups. The suspension rate seems to be fairly high and not given out equally. So those are some of the areas that we are kind of looking at, especially with the different organizations here in Howard County.
The impact of Columbia, I think, has spread beyond Columbia's borders on interracial relations here in our county and thereby in the state of Maryland. There are, you might know the statistics, I don't know the statistics, but I know that at one point in Columbia, this has been quite a few years ago now, maybe 30 years ago, but the average income of African American males of a certain age was higher than it was for the counterpart of white people here in the county. So it was a place that really drew a very talented people who wanted to live in a community that was integrated. Where do you think we still have the most need for improvement in either county government or state government or in areas that aren't regulated by government, like in our business community?
Well, I think many years ago, they used to have a program in the school system, vocational schools, where they taught young people how to use their hands. And I think that that might be something that we need to go back and look at, because everybody is not going to go to college. And so I think that the ones who do not want to go to college should be able to go and have some of the skills so that they can make income that's going to be something that can be suffice for their family.
I would agree to that. I am now and have been since 1973, with 46 years, an independent businessman. I have not worked for anybody except me since 1973. I left a job as an electronics engineering manager to go into a field that I knew absolutely nothing about, because my next older brother had gotten into that work here in Columbia, and that was hauling trash. So I spent the next, from 1973 until 1999, that was my work. And it was the most enjoyable work I'd ever done, although I'd done a lot of exciting things as an engineer, seen a lot of the world, did a lot of exotic things as far as designing pieces of equipment that could find satellites in the sky and that kind of thing. But this was the most interesting work that I'd ever done. And it is work that needs to be done, has to be done. I can remember when I used to go, when I was younger, still doing that work, because I sold that business in 1999. And I would go to schools, and there would be firemen, there would be doctors, there'd be all, and the question would usually arise, what was it that I did? So I said, what I do is I make it possible for the firemen and the doctors and everybody else to live long lives. And nobody could ever guess what that was. And that is because, and then I'd have explained to them what it was, because if you don't manage the waste properly, you can't create enough doctors or whatever to keep people from dying. That's what happens in third world countries. That's why third world countries are third world countries, is because they don't have good waste management procedures. Then there's good money to be made in that business, not only as an owner, but as a person who drives those trucks. Most people don't know it, but those trucks that pick up the dumpsters, those things are like, you don't want to put in everybody behind the wheel on one of those things. Those things are like $300,000 a piece. Mm. They're not cheap. And those people, my people, earn $30,000-$40,000 a year driving those machines. So there's work out there to be done. And what Bessie says is true. There needs to be some emphasis put back on the vocational side of things, as plumbers, electricians, all of that.
How do you think we're doing on that waste issue? Are we gaining ground, losing ground? And I guess that's as a nation, as a local community here.
I'm not sure exactly how I would put it. I know back in the middle 80s, I had to go down to testify before Congress on an issue of interstate commerce, which was transporting waste across state and county lines. And of course, the at that time, the Congress was considering banning that practice. But everybody generates a waste, but nobody wants it to be handled or disposed of near them. So, and that's still the case. So I'm not sure if we're making progress or if we're just kind of standing still.
When I returned home, I read actually about the final decisions by the state legislature on a lot of public policy in this year's session, and I see that we're going to be the first state to ban styrofoam containers.
Yes.
You have any thoughts on that?
It should have been done a long time ago.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, there's not a lot of plastic waste there. But it's cheap and it's easy and it's convenient for people. And the problem is to get people to understand that what is convenient for them is not always the good thing, is a good thing for the country.
That's very interesting, learning about your background. I could talk to you about that for a long time. But we need to move on. And with all of the, every time there's a mass crisis where many people are harmed and damaged, I'm thinking now of New Zealand, and we continue to be shocked, and I guess that's a good thing. We don't want to get to the point where we're not shocked. But as our little community here, although you don't live here now, you grew up here, and you, Bessie, grew up and live here now, what do you think is the best thing we could do in the area of race relations to not only safeguard our own community against greater and greater and greater hatred, but also to take the blessings or the benefits that we've had of living in this great community to set an example? You know, is there anything, one thing you can think of that we could do in our schools or wherever that could, and I'm going to use the word love, and I don't mean it in a romantic way, that we could promote love versus hate in our own community?
I find a lot of times when we have forums that we always use the older people to be the one doing all the talking. I think that if we listen to our young people and give them an opportunity to really set up the forum kind of thing and let them be the leader, let them be the guiding, and listen to them. I don't think that we listen to our young people enough. We hear them, but we really don't listen to them, and we want to make sure that they listen to us. Let's put our young people out front some more. Let them be in charge. Let them set up these things. And I think that would be much helpful than always having the expert be in charge.
Thank you for that. That's beautifully said, and I do agree with you. As I walked into the building here at the community college today, I was greeted by five different pair of students. They're having poetry day here at the college, and they're so interested. It was just so great to see so many young people so deeply interested in poetry and wanting to hear about what were my favorite poems and talk a little bit about theirs. So I think that fits in with what you're saying. I want to thank the two of you for being here today. It's your wisdom, your stories, your life stories that are similar to mine in some ways, but in other ways you've lived through some things that I can't begin to know what it's like to live through. So I'm so glad that you are spending your time speaking out in the community, telling your stories, doing what you can to help us move forward with more love and less hate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Reflections on Life. Until next time, this is Liz Bobo.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.